If you want to grieve the passenger pigeons, that's great. They're gone. If you want to grieve the Eskimo curlews, grieve them. But don't grieve the salmon, because they're still here. And it's not about you. It's about them. And fight like hell to save them. If someday they're gone, grieve then. Okay, this is without a net. Carrying grief as a dark companion in action. I've never forgotten something that an activist said to me back probably 1997. She was a pesticides activist in Minnesota, I believe. She said that sometimes she feels like the only things that keep her going are rage and sorrow. And there has been, I think as environmentalists, many environmentalists, I think, have an appropriate response to grief. But there are also some people, I think, have inappropriate responses to grief, in that I see it sort of falling into two camps, neither of which are helpful. One is the camp that pretends things aren't as bad as they really are and tries to always put a positive spin on things. For example, I can't tell you how many times editors at magazines have said to me, "So I want you to write about the apocalypse, but make sure to end on a happy note." And you can't really leave people in. There's this terror of despair. And oftentimes it feels like we spend more time attempting to avoid feeling despair than we do actually trying to stop this culture from murdering the planet. The problem is, and then there are people who do feel that appropriate grief and do use that grief to fuel their activism, but I also see something else that makes me very uncomfortable as the end on a happy note, let's make sure this is fun and cheerful. And the other one is the people who attend more to their grief than they do to their own grief, than they do to doing whatever is necessary to stop the murder of the planet. And so they turn this. I've actually seen books where people will talk about using the murder of the planet as an opportunity to get in touch with your own feelings. And I have as little patience for that as I do for the avoidance of the despair. Because what both of those ultimately end up being about is the avoidance of action and the avoidance of responsibility. And I often think about this. You know, I have been in some scary sort of life and death situations. And traditionally, what I have done in those situations is put my feelings aside. Like one time, this is not life and death, but it was a car could end up getting kind of mashed up. It was very, very icy. I was living in Spokane, extremely icy. My car slid off the road, and then another car was coming, and it started sliding. It's not moving very fast, but without even thinking, I jumped in between the two cars, put my feet against my car, my back against their car, and as they were sliding, I then sort of guided it so the cars wouldn't smack into each other. It was moving very slow. It wasn't like it was going 20 miles an hour. It was moving like a mile an hour, but it was unstoppable. And I was able to save both cars from getting all messed up. And that's a trivial example, and it's kind of stupid to put yourself in danger to protect your car from getting messed up. Leave that aside. That's not the point. The point is that during that time, I acted. And then afterwards, I was like, wow, that I could have smushed myself. Or a better example is when I was having a very bad flare of Crohn's in my 20s, my mom was in the UK and I was dying, and she got on a plane and flew directly from the UK to Salt Lake City, rented a car, drove from Salt Lake to Elko, where I was in the hospital. That's a four-hour drive. She hasn't slept the whole time yet. Then confronted the doctor. The doctor was doing all sorts of wrong things. Meanwhile, she had called Salt Lake City. They were ready to get me over there if Elko would release me. Elko wouldn't release me. So she pulled the needles out of my arm. She carried me to the car. She drove. She's completely sleep deprived and hasn't slept, and drove back to Salt Lake City. Then when we got to Salt Lake City and when I was on the gurney, when I was being wheeled in, then she can start freaking out about her son's going to die. But until then, you do what you can, and you grieve later. And likewise, my mom had cancer and she died last year, and I was the sole caretaker, and I didn't really have time to grieve, and I didn't cry in her presence. I didn't wail in her presence and make this about me. It wasn't about me. Everything was about her. Once she is dead, there's plenty of time to cry. But when she's not dead, we do everything necessary. We fly her to Houston to see if it's operable. We do everything we can. And it's the same on the larger picture. If you want to grieve the passenger pigeons, that's great. They're gone. If you want to grieve the Eskimo curlews, grieve them. But don't grieve the salmon, because they're still here. And it's not about you. It's about them. And fight like hell to save them. If someday they're gone, grieve then. You know, there's a line I never really understood when I was a kid. Jesus says to his disciples before, you know, they all know that he's going to die soon. And he says, you know, don't grieve now. I'm still here. And you can grieve when I'm gone. And it's the same. It's Joe Hill. You know, don't mourn, organize. Yes, there is tremendous grief. Sure. We need to feel it. But only insofar as feeling that grief facilitates you acting to protect your beloved. Because if you're not acting to protect your beloved, then it's not your beloved. And what we need more, here's the thing. Yeah, I think grief is incredibly important, but I don't think we need to learn how to grieve the planet. I think what we need to do is to learn how to love the planet.